Afghanistan and Iraq. And we've been working ever since to try to move our government away from this militaristic response to all conflicts and to move it away from this war economy to a peace economy. We have been growing tremendously in the last 10 months because people around the country want to join groups like ours. And we now have chapters all over the United States. We have some chapters in Europe as well. And we're excited about that growth because we think it's important not only to deal with the present issue around Gaza, but the much larger issues of militarization and moving to a peace economy.
And last question, it's very important in all this to talk to the militarists, isn't it? It's important to make them think that you feel that they are humans just like you and I are. We've got to engage with them. Do you think this is just fuzzy thinking, or do you think that's true?
Well, there are certainly many members of the military who don't want, for example, to go to war with Iran. And we talk to a lot of people in the military on a regular basis, as well as people who have left the military, some of them quite recently because they don't agree with the government's policies. I just met a young woman this week who turned in her resignation because of the policies around Gaza and support for Israel. And she said that there is great discontent within the military about these policies and that they really want to move the military to one where they're defending the United States, not using the military as an aggressive force. So you're right. We have to talk to people in the military. We have to talk to people who recently left. And of course, there are the elders who left a long time ago, back in the days of Vietnam, like Veterans for Peace, who continue to do terrific work focusing on the tremendous mistakes that the U.S. makes in using its military in ways that are not trying to solve conflicts, but are actually aggravating conflicts.
Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much for having me on, David. A pleasure to talk to you.
Medea Benjamin is a co-founder of the American feminist anti-war group Code Pink. We'll link to Code Pink at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Another rallying cry. From the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. Sounds righteous, no? Calling for freedom or an end to non-freedom? According to allies and advocates of the Jewish State of Israel, this popular slogan is actually horridly anti-Semitic, a vulgar rallying cry for racial hatred and genocide. In the Federal Republic of Germany, shouting out this phrase can land you a stiff fine or get you fired. Earlier this month, a Berlin court slapped a 600 euro fine, that's about 600 US bucks, on a young German Iranian woman for shouting out this two-phrase declaration at a Berlin rally 4 days after Hamas's assault on southern Israel. Bad timing. According to a court spokesperson, the slogan could only be understood as a denial of Israel's right to exist. All the more reprehensible, Judge Birgit Balzer sniffed, given Germany's responsibility for the horrors of the Holocaust and its sacred obligation to make things right, Germany's perpetual obligation to make Jews feel safe and comfortable. Staatsräson, it's called, reason of state. To learn more about Staatsräson and the hazards of calling for Palestinian liberation in Germany, the GPM reached out to Wieland Hoban. Hoban is chairman of Jewish Voice for a Just Peace in the Middle East, Jüdische Stimme. Wieland, I'd like to get into exploring what Staatsräson is in Germany and why the German Federal Republic has such a love affair, if I can call it that, towards Israel. But just the other day, the Tiergarten District Court in Berlin found this 22 or 23-year-old guilty for crying out, "Palestine shall be free from the river to the sea," and fined her 600 euros. Can you talk about that?
Well, that slogan has become a real battleground for the Palestine Solidarity Movement and its persecution by the German state. And there have been rulings on this going both ways. So you often have people being arrested during a demonstration or after it for shouting that slogan. And then in cases where there have been criminal charges filed against them, it has also led to these charges being dismissed in court. And obviously this will be appealed, and the verdict is on very shaky ground, because the legal logic or mechanism that people try to use essentially is about whether this slogan can be considered hate speech, or, to translate the German term, incitement of the people towards hatred. There's a legal gray area, and it also depends on which paragraph of the law one tries to leverage here, because there's the one paragraph about incitement, but then there's also another paragraph, which some authorities have tried to implement, regarding the promotion of forbidden organizations using symbols representing them. So if we take a proscribed organization like Hamas, and if I wear their logo on a t-shirt, then clearly I am promoting a proscribed organization, and so I'm breaking the law. But what has been claimed and what people have tried to enshrine in law is that the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," is so strongly connected to Hamas that it can be considered a representation of the organization. And so that if I say that, I am promoting Hamas. And this is just obviously and demonstrably false. This slogan was being used 20 years before Hamas even existed. And so what people try to do is to prove that somehow the use of this slogan occurred in a context where it indicates a support for acts of violence carried out by Hamas, namely, in this case, what happened on the 7th of October. And because with this recent case, this woman had called out the slogan shortly after the 7th of October, people argue that the condition of contextuality that applies to this slogan, because there is an admission that there is an ambiguity to it, that the context of it coming after that attack of the 7th can be considered an act of approval, of promotion.
And of course, the reality is that from the river to the sea, the state of Israel is one single apartheid state. If you cross into Israel across its eastern border at the King Hussein Bridge, you get an immigration stamp, you're in Israel. So Israel is one single state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, and it's an apartheid state. So it's hugely ironic that to say "from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free," this is anti-Semitic, it's genocidal. But the fact of the matter is that it's quite the opposite.
Of course. And the whole approach used by states and organizations and institutions to suppress free speech on Palestine revolves around a bad faith twisting of what meaning is, and it relies on insinuation. And so if you say something, then what you're actually saying and what you say is your intention behind it, that's not enough, because they all say, "Well, you say that, but what you actually mean is this," or, "When you say Zionists, you're actually talking about Jews. And when you say Palestine will be free, what you actually mean is that it'll be free of Jews, because all of them will be kicked out or murdered." Right? So any space of potential ambiguity, or, I mean, I don't even think it's very ambiguous if I say that this whole area of historic Palestine between the river and the sea that there exists a state of unfreedom and that it's necessary to change that into a state of freedom for all people, I don't think that that's really all that ambiguous. That one thinks, you could mean something benign, but you could also mean something violent.
What is Staatsräson in Germany?
Well, this term has become known in Germany in its German translation, but it was originally used a couple of centuries ago in French, raison d'état, and I think using this somewhat unusual and antiquated term has obscured the fact that this is really just what one calls the national interest in English.
Staatsräson means reason of state.
Exactly, but what it means is the alleged interests of that state at the institutional level, at the power level.
And why is it in the interests of why did German leadership, going back, I suppose, to Konrad Adenauer, you can take us back there, why did they and why do they consider ironclad support for Israel to be in the state's interest?
Well, after the Second World War and after the Holocaust, Germany was initially a pariah state. It's hard to imagine now, but it wasn't just a case of military defeat in the war. It was a case of real, it sounds a bit flippant to talk about bad image, but really much of the world was disgusted by what Germany had done. And it wasn't considered initially, part of the so-called civilized Western world for a while. I mean, the Americans, in the first time after the war, during the American occupation, and actually after that occupation also, the Americans conducted projects that were supposed to basically to civilize Germans again, to democratize them. For example, for arts, even quite obscure avant-garde music institutions, for example, there's a whole interesting history there, was considered as part of Germany's re-democratization, teaching the Germans to be civilized again after they had perpetrated this immense crime. And so there was a real problem of legitimacy. And Adenauer understood that after these crimes against the Jews, and it's maybe also worth mentioning that he wasn't really thinking of the other victims of the Nazis, but after these crimes against the Jews, what was really needed for Germany to be rehabilitated as a player on the international stage again was to somehow resolve that problem. And the most obvious way to resolve that, now that there was a Jewish state, or a state that called itself the Jewish state, this was taken as the go-to representation of Jews as such, Jews in general. So therefore, the idea was that if you come to be on good terms with the Jewish state, then that will give you a kind of moral legitimacy, the idea that you have compensated to some degree for what you've done. And in the 50s, Adenauer began this process and was actually soon selling arms to Israel. And in the early 60s, then the actual reparations program was agreed with David Ben-Gurion.
And a colleague of yours said, it's a wonderful quote, it's not about Auschwitz, it's about NATO.
That's right, yeah. That was Dror Dayan. And that's really the realpolitik underneath the whole moral narrative that has brought us to the point where we are. Because in the end, it's about being part of the Western imperialist project. And even 50 years before the founding of Israel, when Theodor Herzl first pitched the idea of the Jewish state to various powerful people around the world, such as the German Kaiser, part of what was supposed to make it attractive to those powerful people was that this would be an extension of Western power in the Middle East. He called it an outpost of civilization in a sea of barbarism, which is maybe a more culturally related definition, but this was really about an extension of Western power in a part of the world where the British the declining British Empire was losing power. And then after the Six-Day War in 1967, the Americans became the imperial patrons who were using Israel as their local branch in the Middle East. And so, of course, Germany doesn't have the kind of imperial power that the US does, but they wanted to be part of that same project and also have a degree of access and influence in the Middle East. And Germany is the second biggest arms exporter to Israel after the US. So we're really also just talking about business, about money.
Germany is the second biggest arms supplier after the United States to Israel.
That's right. And since October, German arms sales to Israel have increased tenfold. They've recently become lower again, but it's very clear that the relationship with Israel is an extremely profitable one. So in much the same way that the U.S. used these phony moral arguments about, you know, bringing democracy to the Middle East to justify the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, Germany uses this decades-old narrative of supporting Israel because of historical responsibility towards the Jews after the Holocaust in order to give apparent legitimacy to all of these decisions and acts that it carries out, which are based on geopolitics. So you can sell weapons to a state that is committing genocide, but you say, well, no, look, this is part of our historical responsibility. And you can get the vice chancellor, Robert Habeck, saying that because of what his grandparents' generation did, because of their crimes, that one must always support the Jewish state, etc. And when that comes from politicians, of course, it's pure propaganda. It's just a cynical cover story. But unfortunately, when you're talking about civil society, there are actually people who believe that. And so in that regard, one has to work on two levels. One has to be informing people in civil society about the many problems of this narrative. And one also has to be fighting against that narrative at the political level by treating it as something that is purely about power and profit.
It's very hazardous in Germany if you're an academic or an intellectual university instructor to be critical of Israel, to call Israel an apartheid state, a settler colonial state, engage in genocide, particularly if you're a person of color or, you know, a Palestinian person living in Germany. And I know of individuals in this sort of situation. It's a lot safer to be critical of Israel if you're Jewish. Talk about this. And also tell me about the Palestine Congress that was shut down. And back in April, I think it was, there was going to be a Palestine Congress taking place, and the German police actually came in and broke it up.
That's right, in April, yeah.
Tell me what happened.
Right. Well, it's important to point out that weeks, maybe months before the actual Congress took place, there was already a campaign of incitement and defamation in the press and among Berlin politicians also, saying that such an event could not be tolerated, that this was a hate summit of anti-Semites, essentially presenting this, which, I mean, the Congress was already in the public domain. There was a website laying out its content and names of people involved. And this was being treated as a major threat to, I guess, not only Jews, but to society as a whole, because of the way that support for Israel is identified with founding principles of Germany. And so really, there was a kind of hysteria being whipped up long before the actual Congress took place. And then there was also some intimidation behind the scenes. For example, one fundraising event at a cafe in Berlin, the police called the proprietors of the cafe and they insinuated that it could be a security problem for them if they hosted this fundraising event. So they didn't directly forbid it or tell them not to hold it, but it was a kind of intimidation, really. And very shortly before the Congress, after they had been trying for weeks to find out where it was taking place, because the organizers, and Jutta Stimmer was among the organizers, alongside several other groups, we had consciously kept the location secret because it's well known from past experiences that once the location for a Palestine-related event is known, especially if it's one that's getting attention and getting people worked up, that there is a possibility of harassment and intimidation towards the proprietors or administrators of that venue. So shortly before the Congress was to take place, the police, they finally traced the venue after we had told them that we had informed them the day before the Congress, and they really intimidated the proprietor to the point where they had him in tears, because they were saying to him, look, basically your business is over if you host this, because you will be known as the person who was responsible for this thing taking place. And basically your name will be mud.
So the event took place and then the police busted it.
That's right. Hundreds of police officers had been assembled for that, for even just the first day. And then after laying down conditions about essentially what could be said and that it's forbidden to say certain things, in the same way as you have at demonstrations, after the first talk and after the second one had just begun, they interrupted that. It was actually a video recording of a talk, and the whole thing had been live streamed as well, and they shut down the live stream and they shut down the video recording. And then they came up after the fact with various justifications. And you had this quite shocking scene where after a lot of police had already been standing at the ready, both inside the venue and outside it, that then you had them just take over the space and shut things down. And for quite a while, there was a sort of limbo because, you know, the organizers and people involved, we were saying, okay, so what's the actual accusation and what is necessary for this to continue? What are you demanding? What are you imposing? And they said, yes, we just have to check that so-and-so, you know, that this speech that had just begun, that it didn't contain any hate speech or any things that are legally relevant or dangerous. But these excuses continued to be sort of drawn out. So first they were saying, yes, we just have to check. We have to get the translator to check that what was said in English is not in any way actionable. Then it was said we could maybe start the next talk, but without the live stream, because we can't be sure whether the next talk might contain something that's not permissible. And so we can't allow that to be diffused to the public, to the world, via this live stream. I mean, they were basically making it up as they went along. And then in the end, then they said that there was a danger that hate speech could occur at this, and therefore that they were shutting it down. And because they treated, there's a kind of rule about an emergency danger, which allows this to happen without any written justification.
Independent Jewish Voices Canada has recently declared itself, adopted a resolution declaring itself to be anti-Zionist. And this was a subject of intense, sometimes, well, certainly very emotional, occasionally acrimonious debate amongst members of IJV Canada. How about Yudish Estima? Is Yudish Estima consider itself to be anti-Zionist? Vilan Toban?
Yes, it does. And I consider myself to be an anti-Zionist. I mean, I know about the whole process and struggle in IJV through my contacts with that organization. And IJV is not the only Jewish organization that has had these kind of debates and arguments. And I think it's a bit of a distraction, because I think it's more important to state the political positions that actually make an anti-Zionist politics, rather than talking about shall we call ourselves that or not. You know, so to me, this is really a kind of distraction from the substance of politics. And, you know, there's also no guarantee when people say, yes, I'm an anti-Zionist and I insist that we use this label. Well, sometimes one should really unpack what that means. And I can say what that means in my case, in our case, political Zionism, not only as it has been implemented in recent years, but as it was conceived from the start, is a project of Jewish supremacy. And in order to achieve justice and equality in historic Palestine, clearly that system has to be dismantled. And what the exact state and administrative structure will look like after the dismantling of that apartheid system, I think it's not really appropriate for us to specify from a distance how we think that people there should run their state. But the very clear foundation of an anti-Zionist position, regardless of whether one calls oneself an anti-Zionist or not, just a position that's in favor of human rights and equality, is that we have to do away with this apartheid system. We have to do away with the occupation that exists outside of the Green Line, make sure there is equality within the Green Line, make sure that Palestinians have the right to return. And of course, there again, the question of what do we do with people if they return, what kind of reparations are necessary, etc. Those are technical details that come after recognizing a fundamental right. So these are things that are central to our position. And incidentally, they're also really the tenets of the BDS movement's principles. So in that sense, we also explicitly support BDS, because if people are against armed resistance, then they should really support unarmed resistance. And BDS is a central method of unarmed resistance. So for us, support for that is crucial. And we also consider it wrong to say that Palestinians are only entitled to use these peaceful methods, because they are dealing with an occupation. They're not just dealing with, social disadvantage. They are dealing with a belligerent military occupation. And armed resistance to that occupation is not just something that activists are demanding. It's something that was laid out by the United Nations. It's not actually controversial. One has to bear in mind, though, that politicians, both the top level, those in power, and those lower down in the major parties, they do know what's happening. Don't believe them when they say any of this. They know what's happening, but they also know that in order to be part of the project of Western imperialism, they can't just come out condemning Israel, and they can't stop arms deliveries, the same way that, of course, the US is not going to condemn Israel, because that means condemning itself and its own geopolitical project. So one has to be very realistic about these people and the system that they are part of.
Wieland Hoban, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Wieland Hoban is a German composer and academic translator and the chairman of Jewish Voice for a Just Peace in the Middle East, Yudische Stimme. Listen to our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and the Harbinger Media Network. Shout out about another Harbinger Media Network podcast you might be interested in, the feminist tech podcast, Cyborg Goddess. Host Jennifer Jill Fellows interviews researchers about the effects of technology, from bicycles to vibrators, birth control to Fitbits, social media to ChatGPT. Cyborg Goddess unpacks it all from a feminist intersectional lens. We'll link to Cyborg Goddess at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Radio Rewind.